This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk with the musicians, composers, movers, and shakers at the Aspen Music Festival and School. Support for summer classical music programming on Aspen Public Radio is provided by the Barnard Fain Foundation. Today we will hear from violinist Simone Porter, David Finkel in Wuhan, and pianist Anton Nell. First, let's hear from opera director Ed Berkeley about the upcoming vocal events here at the Aspen Music Festival and School, starting with Stephen Sondheim and his musical, A Little Night Music, July 13th and 15th.
I think Little Night Music, it's a very audience-friendly score.
Mm-hmm.
The text is important, which it always will be with Sondheim,
mm-hmm.
but the music itself, I think, is very, very appealing.
To me, it almost becomes close to classical in a way.
Well, and that's why when we were talking about the season, pairing it with Figaro is deliberate,
mm-hmm.
because they both deal with issues, related issues in terms of family and marriage and love and desire. And there are a lot of themes in it, obviously from very different perspectives,
mm-hmm.
but there are a lot of themes in both that connect the two pieces. But the musical vocabulary is so different.
How contemporary are you planning on making it? It seemed to be a piece of its time, but it also seems to be a piece that could be played in any time frame.
Well, one of the choices with Little Night Music, in terms of period, was that it feels of the period Sondheim intended, that is, around mm-hmm. the turn of 1900-ish, Sweden-ish, Ingmar Bergman-ish.
Right.
And so that it feels of that period, and we are definitely staying in that period, in that the clothing is very much of that period.
Mm-hmm.
And then the space it's happening in is a little more modern in feel.
Mm-hmm.
But the characters and the relationships are universal, I mean, in terms of time. I mean, they're very understandable as any time.
Well, both of these works are obviously very sexy as well. What are the challenges that you have as a director, getting people who don't know each other and are not used to acting as much as a more seasoned actor or actress might be,
right.
in terms of breaking down the physical barriers so that they can really have a chemistry with somebody if they actually have no interest whatsoever
character? I spend a fair amount of time teaching acting in New York and
yes.
other things. And one of the things is helping each actor, each singer, find a sense of themselves as a person, essentially their own security and confidence in being open with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only sexuality, but it's also just an openness of emotional who you are, how much you'll let yourself, your own vulnerability show. Certainly in Night Music, there are great moments where there's real anger.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, sometimes it's almost as hard to get an actor to fully express anger as it is to be open to a sexually, you know, alive moment. It's all of those things combined, really.
Both of them have a certain physicality to them, too, which goes beyond just the sexy romp aspect of it. And for that, and in the sense of timing, because both of them require that, it would seem to be a real challenge for you as a director and for the actors timing right and all that, too.
Absolutely. And one of the things with Night Music, which I'll be addressing this week, is getting the specific sense of style for each character,
mm-hmm.
because the characters are very different. And each of them needs to feel like you know that person. An audience needs to feel like they know that person quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things in musical theater is that you meet a character and then their behavior reveals who they are very quickly. In opera sometimes, it's not necessarily slower, but there's more time in opera to start to figure out who a character is.
To build the sense of character.
To build the sense of the character.
Moving on to just all the vocal things that are happening, I have to tell you, I have a radio show back in Boulder during the rest of the year, and I decided to put together a list of all the vocal things that are happening up here in Aspen. And I find myself talking for minutes and minutes on end because there's a lot.
There is a lot.
Renee Fleming, for example, coming in on August 1st with the Emerson String Quartet. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about how vocal music is weaving itself into the program, because this seems to be something that is on a general growth trajectory, as it were.
Well,
there's a lot more than it has been 10 years ago, say.
I think it is more than it was 10 years ago, mostly because it's a similar number of performances of the operas that we do,
mm-hmm.
whether they're in the Wheeler or in the semi-stage form in Harris. That's relatively similar to where we've been. What's different is that, and this is largely part of Asador and with Alan and Spano, doing more vocal chamber works in the course of the summer. And whether they're with guest singers, like with Renee, who comes in to do, and this is a premiere piece, it's an event, or with students in the program who are getting to stand up and do, you know, a 10 or 15 minute cycle. This has been an increase, which I welcome really quite strongly mm-hmm. because it gives them very different experiences as performers where they have to learn in essentially a recital situation how to handle music well and communicate well with an audience without production.
So there's one work that you're doing, Missy Mazzoli's Proving Up, which is coming up on July 30th. I'd like to ask about that because I know nothing about that work, and I expect that most of our audience knows nothing either.
Right. I'll tell you that it's terrific. It's a new piece. It's a very mm-hmm. new piece and is not a premiere, but there's a new piece this year. It addresses homesteaders in the Midwest in the 19th century mm-hmm. and the struggle for survival and whether these people can prove themselves worthy of the land that they've settled on. It's about surviving in society and surviving in climate and social and personal issues in a world that's not necessarily friendly. I heard the piece in New York this year, and one of the things about it is that it's vocally, I think it's difficult, but I think it's a very audience-friendly piece. I don't know Missy personally, but Missy's style of writing for The Voice, I think, is very, very good. It's very singable music, and sometimes mm-hmm. when we've done new pieces, the new pieces feel a little bit like it's a collection of squeaks or something. But Missy writes a real vocal line, mm-hmm. and she also uses orchestration that supports the period and style of the characters very strongly. Mm-hmm. So that I think it's a very intriguing piece of writing. And the librettist for it, Royce Vavrek, uses a very interesting range of language because it's a mixture of very conventional language with imagery that just jumps at you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's always tricky when you have something that's like totally new. How do you find that audience? Mm-hmm. But I think that she, as a writer, as a composer, and he as a librettist, are doing something pretty wonderful in the new works world.
It certainly seems exciting to me to think of writing an opera about trying to scratch a living out of the earth.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, conceptual and difficult.
Yeah. I mean, how to make that work. I don't think I would try to take that on as a librettist or an opera.
And I think we have an audience here that will be excited by this. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, people who are interested in new pieces. And part of what's wonderful about our doing it is that obviously the Sondheim and the Mozart are conventional in terms of, well, Mozart is standard, but they're both recognized pieces. Mm-hmm. And then we have this, which is completely, you know, new.
Right. And a lot of the audience hungers for that.
Yes.
Ed, thank you again for your time.
Good. Thanks.
Always appreciate it.
I'm very glad to be here.
Opera director Ed Berkley talked about the upcoming vocal events here at the Aspen Music Festival and School, starting with the Stephen Sondheim musical, A Little Night Music, July 13th and 15th. Now let's hear from violinist Simone Porter, who will be playing a Prokofiev violin concerto this evening with the Chamber Symphony. Well, Simone, I'm glad you came into town in enough time for me to be able to talk to you and interview you and talk a little bit about the Prokofiev violin concerto. One thing that people who know Prokofiev a little bit, they think of his music as being, like, you know, really rhythmic and propulsive mm-hmm. and all that, but it starts so lyrically in this case.
Yes, I love this concerto, in part because it has two of my favorite expressive markings mm-hmm. ever. So it begins with the marking sognando, which means as if in a dream, and then a couple minutes later it says narrante, which means narrating. And I sort of take those as directives for the mm-hmm. entire piece. I think of myself almost as a tour guide to this dreamscape, to mm-hmm. this sort of dream reality. And so it starts with this just whispered sound. It's just the violas doing tremolo and the violin comes in and everything is very misty. It's almost as if notes, phrases are materializing just when you reach them. And eventually it crescendos into something kind of ghostly, but also very eerie, a little wacky. Mm-hmm. It's like spectral characters are rising out of the ashes, or you're confronting all of these entities or situations that, you know, only make sense when you're asleep, when you're dreaming. that's sort of how the first movement goes, except then the end of the first movement, and this happens again at the very end of the entire concerto, is really special because I feel like at that point, Prokofiev's depiction of the dream moves from being about the action to the texture itself. The violin is floating up at the highest part of its register, pianissimo, basically in a trio with the harp and the flute, and it mm-hmm. sounds like, to me, like Prokofiev was trying to transcribe ether or something. Like he was
Right.
Writing out the, you know, the texture, what a dream would actually feel like. There's just so many really, really interesting textures, colors throughout this concerto that make it a really, really great piece to play and a great piece to collaborate on, just because, you know, every player, every orchestra does it so differently. So there's endless inspiration.
I wonder too, as a young performer, I wonder if you find it a challenge in this day and age to capture people's attention when the attention span of people tends to be getting lower and lower. Do you have any thoughts on that? Because you're going to be asking people to concentrate quite a bit in this Prokofiev, mm-hmm. as only one example.
I aim to give performances that are obviously engaging enough mm-hmm. that they do capture attention. For me though, the attention that's required when performing and when watching a performance is so relevant precisely because I am a millennial in my 20s mm-hmm. who is constantly in the world of clickbait, of Twitter, of news feeds or whatnot. I feel the effects of the modern day attention economy in which my attention is, you know, bought and sold by these mm-hmm. media companies. I feel that effect in my head very frequently, and I look forward to performances, whether as a performer or as an audience member, because I feel like they act as a bomb on that abuse mm-hmm. of attention. So the opportunity to be engaged at length in a crowd has seemed to me like something in classical music concerts that is a strength rather than something that can turn away. I know some of the things I think we're talking about is always how to attract younger people, how to attract people from my generation. I'm 22, mm-hmm. how to attract my peers. And I know that a lot of times the discourse is playing things that are shorter, that are faster, that are movie scores or something. And I think that is, those are all valid things to say. But I think that extended attention and concentration are actually really pros, are really something that should be nurtured and something that should be publicly marketed, because mm-hmm, they mm-hmm. are the antithesis of this sort of whiplash that we experience from every other service. I wish that classical music was presented in the same way as something that can balance, that can reset, that can cleanse from just the fast-paced and sort of abusive of just all these other services that we're constantly interacting with.
And I guess my last question really has to do with just your heart and how you give that to your music, because mm-hmm. there are certainly pieces I've heard you play where I just go, oh my God, it's as if she went through that tragedy or whatever. Can you say a little bit about that when you're playing a piece of music that has tragedy or mm-hmm. great lyric intensity, how you give yourself to it?
Absolutely. I think most of my work in the past couple of years has been how to let go with control, honestly, on stage. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like, you know, when you're a student, playing the violin is really hard. So yes. the things you're learning are control, how to do something accurately, how to really just cultivate the necessary tools so that you can express what you want to. And after that, it's time to trust yourself enough to mm-hmm. let go. So when playing something like Schindler's List, tapping into the tragedy that John Williams himself was trying to convey, you can't do that without your heart on your sleeve, honestly. Mm-hmm. It's paradoxical because it requires so much stability to be utterly vulnerable and unchained. And that's, mm-hmm. I think, the challenge every time going on stage. The way I get close to pieces is usually I often think about pieces in terms, in literary terms or in narrative terms. When I was a kid, I used to look to books a lot, very programmatically. Like, if I played a piece that was, you know, like Schindler's List and that it depicted a tragedy, and I was, you know, 10 years old, I didn't know what was going on, I would look to the precision that's possible with a verbal medium and see how that could be expressed musically. Now, I think the power of storytelling, stories, character-based, things like that, I still really conceive of pieces mm-hmm. in those terms. So I think that's one of the reasons I love playing this Prokofiev that I'm doing this week, because the whole piece is like a fairy tale. From the start, with the markings, as if in a dream, and narrating, I think that's the entire concerto. I think the whole thing could exist on the umbrella of Once Upon a Time. Entering that magic is, you know, everything I dream of.
Right. Simone, I know you're very, very busy. Thank you for making your time to come back in here again, and maybe we'll talk next year or the year after again when you come. I'm sure you're going to come back to Aspen again.
I hope so, yeah. Yes. Fingers crossed. But anyway, thank you so much for having me.
You can hear violinist Simone Porter this evening at 6 with the Aspen Chamber Symphony. Now let's catch up with cellist David Finkel and pianist Wu Han. Wu Han, David Finkel, it's always a pleasure and an honor to see you here at Aspen Public Radio. Thanks for coming in for yet another season and for making it up to the Aspen Music Festival before music at Menlo devours the rest of your summer.
Yes, it's always a pleasure to come back to this festival. It's very, very special to both of us.
So this year, not only are you doing your famous cello and piano duet, but you are also bringing in a violinist, Paul Huang, who I don't believe has been seen by Aspen audiences. Is that correct? And how did you find this person?
Well, you know, in CMS, we have the Bowers Program, which is the program that we use to groom young artists. And we use the platform of chamber music to put together groups so the younger musician can have opportunity to play with senior musicians. And we have quite a lineup of great violinists in the last 10 years. Arnold Sussman, you heard last summer, was one of them. This year we decided to bring in another new violinist, Paul Huang, who is also in the program and who's a great violinist. And you actually, the Aspen audience, will also have the great opportunity to hear two others, Chad Hoops and the Brandenburg, and then Angelo Yu as well. They both are also with the roster in Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. But we are so happy that Paul said, yes, I'm going to be free, and I'd love to play in Aspen. So actually, David and I were just talking earlier. Paul has this incredible fat sound. So we both have to say, wow, we got to catch up with this young kids.
Right. Well, David, you'll be playing the Saint-Saëns, of course, and the Tchaikovsky, the two piano trios, both of which do have very lush sound, I think, for the cello. So tell us a little bit about these pieces and why the two of you chose them as the pieces you wanted to feature this summer.
Saint-Saëns' first trio, and he composed two. The second one was not till quite a few years later. But this first trio is one of the very earliest pieces of French chamber music in the Romantic era. It's from the early 1860s. There are scant few works by any other French composers from that time. César Franck, who was, of course, Belgian, got it going a little earlier, but not with as much output as Saint-Saëns. This is a delightful work. It has sometimes a Mendelssohnian character, but other times it's distinctly French and in a very, very wonderful way. It's incredibly skillfully written. We know that Saint-Saëns was one of the great child prodigies of all time. His facility in composition, also at the piano, is very much in evidence. We learned this piece only within the last few years ourselves. We programmed it with other people playing it, and we've gotten involved in doing it ourselves. Wuhan and Paul Huang recorded this with another cellist last summer at Music at Menlo, our festival. So Paul and she know it, and I'm just catching up with them. Tchaikovsky's trio, which is one of the most monolithic pieces in the whole chamber music repertoire, of course, was written towards the end of his career in memory of his great mentor, Nikolai Rubinstein, the pianist who founded the Moscow Conservatory. And Tchaikovsky struggled with this trio. He was not happy writing for the combination of two strings and piano. He didn't find that it came naturally to him to do it. But it's happened many times that composers who complain bitterly about their compositional difficulties wind up creating unbelievable masterpieces. And this is one of them. It's an enormous work with an enormous symphonic first movement, an incredible set of variations, and a final return of the opening theme that just really leaves the audiences drained and breathless and us in awe of this creation of Tchaikovsky's.
I think of this piece as being, you know, Tchaikovsky thinking of himself as an orchestral composer. And he made this one sound orchestral thanks to all the notes on the keyboard that he threw at you. So you're going to have some tired fingers by the end of this, too, with Tchaikovsky.
Yes. It's a program that actually we turn it in. We said, wow, there's so much contrast and Beethoven sonatas and, you know, Beethoven celebrations coming and the delightful French lightness and then the intense Tchaikovsky. And we did the programming. We turned it in. And I started to practice the program. I said, my God, what did I do to myself? Oh, no. This is the best thing you could do is ask, but I know it's not possible, ask to be paid by the notes.
Right.
I don't think it's going to happen this time.
We need to talk to Asador about that, I guess, don't we?
Yeah, but I enjoy the challenge, and I also enjoy really pacing, really making three, the German, the French, and the Russian, complete different sensation and different color. The Saint-Saëns has to be just light and fluffy, and like you take your Prudhoe to the Champs-Élysées, and Beethoven has to have incredible discipline. The Tchaikovsky, it's just sound production and passion.
Well, Wuhan, I want to ask you one other question. I usually like to try and go back and forth, but this one I have to ask you about, because this season of the Aspen Music Festival has kind of a theme of being American. And here on the radio, at Aspen Public Radio, we're doing a lot of the emigres, you know, Korngold and Rachmaninoff and others who came oftentimes from very oppressive conditions in Europe over to the United States, and other times just because they wanted to be Americans. And you were one of those emigres, not as a composer, but as a performer. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit what it took for you to come here? How much of a challenge was it for you to become American?
I came to America by actually good fortune. Mm-hmm. I have a very established career. I also taught a lot when I was young at a huge studio. And I also play viola and percussions and flute and all other instruments, so I was very useful in the orchestra setting. I can play a concerto in the first half and made the second salary morph into either the percussion session or the viola section. My teacher came to Taiwan and heard me and said, you should come to America because it's the greatest country. And I swear to God, my mother said this. She said, go to America for a couple of years and you'll get some kind of degree or honor or prizes, which I got a lot in Taiwan, and you can come home and charge more. And you know, I landed in America, I fell madly in love with everything about this country. The openness, the creative, the anything that's possible, the opportunities, and incredible generous people, the spirit. I learned about the arts, and I also met so many great, 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 great musicians. I was so excited that there's new voices and chamber music. Also, there's very little chamber music in the Far East. So still, it's not a lot. And all these new discovery, I found myself wanted to be a different person.
Were you a part of helping her become that different person, David, the husband of some 30 years or whatever?
I would say definitely a big yes.
You know, the Wuhan was very, very impressive student pianist. There was I felt an instant musical rapport with her, and everybody that played with her also felt that, like, oh, she understands, she gets it, she can listen, she can make, I can make music with this person. In terms of her potential as a leader in the industry, which she certainly is now, I had no idea what was coming, but somehow instinct told me that she could thrive in America, that opportunities would present themselves. And one of the very earliest opportunities that presented itself was the Aspen Music Festival, where her teacher, Lillian Kallier, with whom she studied on and off, said, come to Aspen as my student. So she came out here roughly the same time that I came here with the Emerson Quartet. Maybe she was here the year after I got here in the early 80s. But out here, she made contact with pianists like Leon Fleischer and Aubie Zirko, Herbert Stesson,
Claude Frank, Edith Oppens,
and that led to a couple of summers at the Marlboro Festival. And then somewhere along in there, we decided to get married. And so then, you know, then we became a couple, but that did not necessarily mean that she had a career. I had a very independent career with my quartet. But she made her way through the industry and played with lots of people, and eventually. And I have to say that Aspen Music Festival, God bless it, was a place that believed in her from the get-go and also believed in me as an individual, not just as the cellist of the Emerson Quartet, which was a rare phenomenon in the days when the quartet was roaring along, for somebody to look at David Finkel and say, you know, he could play without them on occasion and not disgrace himself. So Aspen was a place that had a kind of faith in the two of us as individuals and eventually, of course, as a duo.
God bless Aspen Music Festival.
Well, we're all looking forward to seeing, my goodness, it's just going to be tomorrow, Saturday, July 6th, for your concert. I hope you never, ever consider missing a chance to come out and play in Aspen for all the people who love you here so much. And David Finkel Wuhan, thank you again so much for coming to Aspen and to our radio station.
Thank you for having us, Chris.
Thank you.
David Finkel and Wuhan join violinist Paul Huang for an evening of piano trios tomorrow evening at Harris Hall. You'll hear pianist Anton Nell over a dozen times more this season in countless chamber music concerts. Let's talk with the Aspen Music Festival's most prolific performer. Anton Nell, we were just chatting, and it sounds like you were going to be up on the stage playing piano 16 times this season at the Aspen Music Festival. Do we have the correct number there?
Yes, Chris, it's right. I think that's a record for me, too. I mean, normally
my goodness.
they're normally at least 8, if not 10, but 16 this year. You know, I guess I could say that I'm never happier than when I have a lot of notes to play. And every single one of these performances are pieces that I like, first of all, and then second of all, people that I really like working with. So it's an absolute win-win.
For starters, you're doing a world premiere before too long here. I think that's on the 8th of July, on Monday.
That's
right. So let's start with that, with the John Harbison. Not only recent, but the ink isn't even dry on this one yet, is it?
Yes. What this is, it's a new viola sonata by the American composer John Harbison. And how this came about was there are 8 violists who are sort of a consortium who are playing this piece. My violist, James Dunham, will be the 4th one. It has already been played 3 times.
Well, I realize this is a pretty standard question, but how do you like having a living composer there, as opposed to, say, when you're playing a Beethoven sonata or something like that?
Well, it has definite pluses, because so many of the pieces that we play from composers of yore, of course, you cannot exactly send them an email or a text message. So you have to rely on what you see in scholarship and tradition. But there are always puzzles that will never be solved. In this instance, you can ask him directly what he would like.
So the very next day, you've got a recital with Christoph Baratti and you, starting with Bach and going on to Ravel, etc. Tell me a little bit about that concert.
Well, I love playing with violin. And this young man, Christoph Baratti, is Hungarian, and he has not played much in the States, if at all. So I think this is kind of an introduction to him. He's young, he's in his 20s, but has a major career in Europe. He's an interesting guy. He's also a champion chess player and a pilot and so on. But I think this will be a really superb concert. The program is, he opens with a Bach solo sonatas, and then we're playing together the Brahms second sonata in A major, as well as a beautiful set of pieces by Tchaikovsky, Souvenir of a Beloved Place, 3, it's a meditation, scherzo, and melody. Then he'll play some Isai solo again, and then we'll finish with a show piece by Ravel, Tzigane.
I'm always curious, because piano has this rigidly fixed 12 notes to the octave equal temperament, mm-hmm. and violins like to play a little closer to the natural tunings. How did the various string players that you work with deal with the difference, the natural difference that there tends to be, or the conflict there tends to be, in just how you tune your instrument?
You know, we cannot adjust, so they must.
Mm-hmm.
And that especially happens when you're playing trios or quartets or quintets, because then within the string group, they have to tune a chord if they have to blend, say, with something that the piano is doing. That can sometimes be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I do this kind of thing on period instruments too, of course, which often have different tunings, and then the adjustments. And the adjustments sometimes are deliberately a little sour to point out the expressivity of the particular instance. But for us pianists with fixed scales, the kind of stuff we dream about is when a violin has an F and an E sharp, which is really the same note to us, but they actually put their finger in slightly a different place for a different color. Mm-hmm. We dream about things like that.
Mm-hmm. You get jealous. You wish you had a
monster. Oh, yes. Especially, you know, when you play composers like, you know, like Schubert, for example, who will often do that in the same measure. So you can only mm-hmm. imagine what that could be like. So it's a special challenge.
Mm-hmm. And you're playing with the orchestra on July 19th. Let's talk just a little bit about that.
Oh, yes.
The Chamber Symphony. So here you're playing the Frank Martin, who is a composer I only discovered a few years ago here at Aspen.
Well, this piece is one of my desert island pieces, and it's a brilliant piece by this by Frank Martin, who's Swiss. What this is, in fact, it's a triple concerto for piano, harp, harpsichord, and 2 string orchestras. And I played it here before about 15 years ago with Alan Gilbert. But when Martin wrote this piece, the point was to use all instruments that have strings. And so the result is something that sounds a little bit like a 20th century Brandenburg concerto, really. Mm-hmm. But the way in which the piece is put together, the way in which these 3 instruments balance and play together with the 2 string orchestras, there are a lot of individual parts. And so the sound that they produce is very lush and rich. And then blending with the 2 keyboard instruments and the plucked solo instrument is amazing. And I've got an absolute dream team playing with me. Annalene Lenertz is the harpist. She's from the Vienna Philharmonic. And then the harpsichordist is Jory Vinokur, who's also absolutely amazing. We've all played the piece before, so I expect that it's going to be a wonderful experience to put together, and it's a spectacular thing to watch too. Well, it's 20th century, but it's very lush and romantic sounding and very brilliant and dancey. It's a superb piece.
Anton, thank you very much. Looking forward to seeing more and more of you up on the stage. Your pianism is an inspiration to all of us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Pianist Anton Nell will be on the Harris Hall stage this Monday and then for over a dozen more performances this season. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk with the musicians, composers, movers, and shakers at the Aspen Music Festival and School. I'm Chris Moore. You can listen to previous interviews on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale.